This is Audible.
Cadian Honor by Justin D. Hill. Read by Colleen Prendergast. Prologue. The Ramillies class Starfort Imperial Heart was a weapon built on the scale of a planetary moon, a behemoth of plasteel and ceramite. 6 months earlier, wheezing tugs had dragged it from its ancient orbit around Holy Terra and pushed it through the hectic space lanes, past the gantry locks, scaffold rigs, and ore barges of Mars, and out to Mandeville Point 4HA. The transition had cost the lives of two navigators. The remaining five had worked without pause or respite as the transparent blue eggshell of the Geller field crackled and strained. One navigator led, while the others kept watch for treacherous warp reefs and sinkholes that could suck the Imperial Heart and its complement of top brass, regiments and ancillary support staff down into madness. The warp had been exultant, like a sea whipped up to a tumult of waves. Brave men went mad. Infected units were purged. Some had nothing but faith to hold on to for the months of travel. When the Imperial Heart was ready for re-entry, the immaterium bulged and strained and finally tore open with a scream of psychic despair. The will of the Emperor held true. The Starfort dropped back into real space with a gout of unholy light. Bulkheads burst open, circulation pipes blew scalding steam, and quadrants vented their atmospheres out as the sudden imposition of the laws of gravity sent shockwaves through the vast craft. Once systems had been suitably stabilised, the plasma generators were powered to maximum, and arc lights within the Imperial Heart's central basilica crackled to life. If any expected a fanfare, they were disappointed. There was no welcome, no joy. The Imperial Heart's galvanic beacons illuminated a massacre. Clouds of Imperial battleships and cruisers hung dead in the void, their frozen guts draped about the broken wrecks in sparkling clouds. As they moved forward, the crews of the longscopes could make individual details out. Amidst the spiral clouds of oxygen ice were trails of plasma slime, water casks, monumental square cases of slowly revolving unexploded munitions, and the corpses of thousands of dead crewmen, some with arms and legs outstretched, others cupped in fetal sleep, all of them glittering with reflected light. The stillness was chilling. It was a wall of death that they had to pass through. Colossal blocks of ice and stone, which for thousands of years had hung in balance, tumbled into the outer void or began to fall towards the sun. The Imperial Heart's own complement of tugboats gently nudged the larger wrecks from her path, while the smaller ones were tipped from their millennia-long orbits by the gravitational pull of the Starfort, and started a deadly spin towards the inner system. As the procession moved deeper into the system, the planet to which the Imperial Heart had been sent began to appear on the projector screens of the long-distance auguries. The Imperium had returned to the world of El Fanor. Once a linchpin in the warp routes between Terra and the Cadian Gate in the years after the Horus Heresy, El Fanor had been a bastion world, the lodestone to the Cadian system. The planet had stood defiant, proud and impregnable to all but the mightiest of warhosts under the mastery of the fierce Cromarchs, who re-engineered their planet to be a flat and featureless killing zone marked only by trenches, rock-crete bastions, and the ventilation stacks of underground barrack cities. They had shrugged off assaults that would have crippled systems and sent chaos armies tumbling back in retreat, until the mightiest of war hosts had come. The traitors of Abaddon, known to the Imperium as the Black Legion. It was the Black Legion that had set about crippling Elphinor with brutal efficiency. Warships had shown the bastion world of her orbiting defence networks and monitors, as the eagle strips the claws from the crab. Each time a defence bastion revealed itself, teleporting Terminators mounted instantaneous retribution. Within a week, there was nothing the defenders could do except watch as the last of the stars went dark. The Black Legion's fleet surrounded the planet like a shell of hate. Veteran Warmasters personally led the assault onto the planet's retrofitted landscape of obstacles, rockcrete redoubts, and trenches. At their fore went Abaddon, who impaled the governor of surface defences through the heart and set his forces in siege about the unbreakable walls of Theodos. It had taken him a fortnight to break through the outer defences, and then they were inside, battering at the grand citadel of Cromarch Paratekon. But none would force an entry until Abaddon himself broke its plasteel gates and led the charge through the outer barbican, where the salvos of disciplined Lasfire were like strobing starbursts. The fortress had a garrison of 2 million veteran warriors. They were like children before the hatred of the Black Legion. Abaddon and his retainers murdered their way through the citadel. Paratekon's 12 sons were slain defending their father, and when he too died, the population of Elphinor was slaughtered, and the planet was systematically stripped of life, ecosystem, and atmosphere. This was the planet to which the Imperial Heart had been sent, like a bride to a dead man's wedding. As the Imperial Heart approached to within hailing distance, the bridge crew sent out the requisite signals and protocols. It was a matter of form. None were answered. The planet was as cold as a morgue slab. The debris cloud of dead ships and defence platforms was as impenetrable as a thicket of iron thorns. The planet was white with the bones of 100 million defenders. The Imperial Heart fell into orbit above the planet and started spinning a web of defence platforms, construction rigs, mechanicus derricks and shear legs. The Ramillies was the centre of 10,000 overlapping contiguous space flights, all working towards a single aim. Explorator brigs, slow-moving shallops and surface barges landed on the barren world. Preachers in rotary-jointed extreme environment suits cleansed it of the taint of chaos, cast down heretic icons, reared the bodies of imperial saints, and made the planet spiritually pure. Archaos surveyors and their gangs of servitor excavators scoured the surface for ancient technology, and when all was ready, tug monitors and pushboats dragged the clenched fists of comets out of their orbits. The dirty celestial snowballs impacted upon the dry world, dumping water and steam, ammonia and methane onto the surface. As the swirling debris settled, plasteel seed pods released clouds of algae spores and specially selected bacteria down into the planet's nascent atmosphere. For a moment, nothing happened. Monitor screens were watched closely. The flat line of lifelessness began to tremble, then spike. It was like a shot to the arm of a long-dead corpse. Elphinor choked and spluttered. It took less than a minute before the planet took a new breath. A pulse had returned. Like a wounded soldier determined to fight on, Elphinor was returning to the battlefront. Part 1. And lo, he had a bronze helmet and wore a coat of bronze. On his legs he wore bronze greaves, and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft was made of iron, and its blade weighed 6 pounds. Book of Samuel. Chapter 1. From the ceiling of the Macarius dining room, situated in upper D quadrant of the Imperial Heart, long chains of gilt-framed portraits hung down the walls. They were the faces of Astra Militarum generals with starched uniforms, gold braid, and rows of ribboned medals, all meticulously reproduced with oil and brush. Many were cracked with age, or stained a deep yellow by centuries of after-dinner smoke. Cadian generals filled one entire wall, a fact that galled the Praetorian general, Sir Reginald Monstella de Barker. He brooded as the table conversation focused on the upcoming crusade. "Who should lead?" a voice queried from the end of the table. "The Cadians," a blunt Catachan voice stated. "This was their territory once, theirs to reclaim." There were murmurs of agreement in a dozen accents, Mordian, Aquarian, Saturnine. Sir Reginald could bear it no longer. He slammed his hand down a little too hard. "No, the Cadians should not lead," he pronounced. "They are not up to it, not now. Not since the debacle of the Cadian Gate. The Mordians are as good as any Cadian outfit, any one of your armies, or indeed my own Praetorians." The other generals, old even by Astra Militarum standards, turned to his end of the table in surprise. Sir Reginald felt emboldened. He gesticulated expansively. "We've given the Cadians everything they wanted since anyone can remember. The best arms, the best supplies, the toughest assignments. But look, the prison warders were caught napping. Their failure has set the whole Imperium in doubt. Where are the Cadians now? See? None of them are here. They daren't show their faces." As he spoke, an ornately carved and decorated antique dining chair scraped back across the polished walnut. There were a few shocked gasps as the man stood and showed himself. He had the same pale complexion as many of the portraits hanging on the wall, the same drab uniform, and the badge of the Cadian Gate, in black on a field of white. He fixed the Praetorian with pale, violet eyes. "If I may say so, General, you don't know what you are talking about." Lord General Reginald de Barker's cheeks coloured, but he ostentatiously swilled the last of the claret about his mouth. "You should address me properly. I am a Lord General, and I know exactly what I am talking about." A frock-coated attendant saw the danger and came forward with a bottle of Amasek. The Cadian put up a hand. "No, thank you." His jaw was tense, his cheeks flushed red. "You may be a Lord General," the Cadian said, "but that does not stop you being a damned fool." The silence deepened. Even the servo waiters stopped in the half-open doorways and stared at each other in slack-jawed confusion, bolts of cream and red sorbet held in their unthinking hands. The Cadian spoke louder this time. "I demand that you withdraw your words." Sir Reginald paused for a moment and then slid his own chair back and stood to his full height of 6'5". "Tell me your name, sir."
"Benedict."
"Well, General Benedict, you cannot demand anything from me. Those days are over. The Cadians are a dying breed. Failure hangs around your necks. Your defeat is like a brand burned into a criminal's cheek. As for your behaviour this evening, I shall expect a formal apology from you and your commander."
Benedict crossed the space between them in two strides.
"Here's my apology," he hissed.
His fist caught the Lord General under the chin. There was a sharp crack of hind teeth being slammed together, a low grunt of pain, and then Benedict was on the bigger man, hands reaching for his throat. It took two of the younger generals to haul him back. At last, they held his arms out to either side and he stood, dishevelled, breathless, furious as a pit slave. Sir Reginald pushed himself to his feet. He dabbed his lip. There was blood. A saturnine dragoon general stepped forward. There were splatters of blood and wine on his white frock coat. His face was severe. "Make peace, men. This will not do, not at all. We are military officers. We all serve the God Emperor. Shake hands, and we shall all forget this happened."
"I would rather die," General Benedict spat.
Sir Reginald put his hand to the worn pommel of his duelling sabre.
"That can be arranged," he said.
Chapter 2.
"Don't record this,"
Lord Militant Warman said to his scribe as he entered Benedict's private chambers. They were on the mid-levels of C Quadrant, and Warmund was Chief Cadian on board the Imperial Heart. He was a slab of a man, solid, ruthless, deeply loyal to everything that his home world had once been. Behind him trailed an entourage of attendants, savants, scribes, and a pair of hovering servo skulls. The sudden bustle within his private quarters shocked Benedict.
"Benedict," Warman said as he strode inside, "I had to take a lighter from A Quadrant, and it's still taken me an hour and a half to get here. You've caused me a lot of trouble."
Benedict leapt to his feet.
"Sorry, sir."
He saluted smartly. Warmund waved him back to his seat.
"I said don't record this," he repeated,
and the bald-headed savant nodded. His metal claw lifted the stylus from the parchment roll. There was nothing organic about the movement. Warman's voice had been enhanced for battlefield audibility, but he kept it to a low rumble now, like the purr of a giant feline. It made the wood-panelled walls tremble.
"Benedict, I've been told that you struck Lord General Reginald Monstella de Barker with your fist. Is that true?"
Benedict paled. He cleared his throat. His voice betrayed him.
"Yes, sir." "Good man."
Warman's face broke into a huge grin.
"We're all glad you hit that pompous prat. He's been challenging our leadership since day one."
He seized Benedict's hand, and there was power within his handshake that Benedict had not felt before. Warman's hand had been augmented, he realised, and as its grip closed on his own, grinding bone and gristle together painfully, he felt the unspoken threat. Warmund let go and paced up and down, hands behind his back, head thrust forward on a thick bull neck. He had a brisk, businesslike manner that was familiar, even though he and Benedict had never met before. It must be, Benedict surmised, a Cadian trait.
"We've all been celebrating your punch, General Benedict, but I'm not beating about the bush here. You'll have to go to that damned Praetorian fool and apologise."
Benedict nodded. He understood. Warmund went on.
"You don't have to do it publicly. I can arrange a private venue. It doesn't even have to be particularly profuse. Sorry if, all that, you know."
Benedict tried to speak, but Warmund kept talking.
"We've allied with the Saturnine Dragoons, and together we're petitioning people with influence. Navigator House Benetech are with us. They tell me that this is going to be the next front line, the new Cadian Gate. Elfenor is on the shortest route from the Cicatrix Melodictum towards Holy Terror, apparently. It's going right to the top, the High Lords of Terror."
Benedict coughed to clear his throat.
"I'm afraid I cannot do that, sir."
"Do what?"
"Apologise, in all good conscience."
Warmund stared at him for a moment.
"I don't care about your damned conscience. The position of the Cadians has become precarious. Vultures are circling, and they wear the two-headed Aquila of the Imperium of Man. De Barker might be the most pompous, but he is not alone. There are a number of other Lord Militants and Lord Generals who think they deserve command. Our representatives are fighting around the clock to make sure Acadian generals retain control of this front. This is the chance we need to repair the loss of Cadia, a chance to regain our glory. Warmond went on at length. At the end, Bendict nodded.
Yes, sir, I understand, but I'm afraid I cannot do as you wish.
Warmond stopped pacing and fixed an augmented eye on him.
Can't or won't?
There was threat in Warmond's voice now, and the water glass on Bendict's bedside cabinet rattled.
I don't care about your pride, Bendict. I'm ordering you to apologise.
Bendict's voice seemed quiet in comparison.
I am very sorry, sir. I cannot. Bendict.
Bendict cut him off.
Sorry, sir. If you would excuse me, but someone has to make a stand. It's not just the ownership of this front that is at stake here. It is the honour and pride of every Cadian who still draws breath.
Warmond started to laugh.
Bendict, be serious. You're a soldier, not a preacher.
I'm a Cadian, Bendict said. And, with respect, this is beneath you. Warmond turned his whole body towards Bendict, and his voice was low and deep and made the whole room rattle.
What do you mean, exactly?
Bendict felt the vibration in his gut.
Cadians have nothing to be ashamed of. We held the Cadian Gate since time... for as long as anyone can remember. Yes, but the Cadian Gate fell. Not through any fault of the Cadians.
Warmond waved a hand in a dismissive gesture.
Don't be an idealist. We've lost whole sectors of Imperial space. Let's face facts. Maybe DeBarker has a point.
Bendict felt his blood rising.
Lord Militant, were you on Cadia?
No, you know I wasn't.
Well then, with all due respect, sir, you cannot say the Cadians failed. DeBarker is wrong. You are also wrong. I was there. I know. We were winning. Creed was winning.
Creed was a word that everyone used once. Now his name was passing into memory. But it gave Bendict strength. Warmond laughed caustically.
If you were winning, how did we lose?
Bendict could barely control himself.
The Imperial Navy let us down. The Imperium let us down. Throne be damned, every Cadian who was not there let us down. Lord Militant Warmond, if you were not there, then you let us down.
Bendict found that he was shouting into Warmond's face. There was a dangerous look in Warmond's eye as he stepped forward. Bendict swallowed, but he did not back down. He was done with manners. He was a soldier and a fighter, and he fought his corner.
How dare you accuse me, Bendict? If anyone failed, it was you and Creed and all the other defenders. Cadia fell on your watch, not mine.
Warmond was shouting too now. The vibrations were sickening, and the bedside lumen cracked. Bendict had to swallow back his nausea as he returned the Lord Militant's stare. He remembered Osaka Creed's words about the dreadful old waxworks who ran the Cadian forces, how hidebound they were, how their war fronts were on holy terror in the infernal politicking of the Administratum. He started to speak, but Warmond put up his hand.
I am fighting the war for the survival of our regiments. That is why you must go and apologise. Today.
Bendict took in a deep breath and paused for a long moment.
I am afraid I cannot, sir.
All the charm had fallen from Warmond. He bristled.
I am giving you an order, Bendict.
Bendict looked to see if there was a commissar in the room.
There was.
Warmond had planned this all along. Bendict had been cornered. He took a deep breath. This was now a matter of life and death. Bendict spoke deliberately,
I understand that, sir. But still, I cannot allow the name of the Cadians to be impugned in this way. That was a command.
From the corner of his eye, Benedict could see the Commissar put his hand to his bolt pistol. Benedict nodded.
I know that. If it means me dying, then that is what I shall do.
He watched as the bolt pistol slid from its black leather holster, then looked away. The Commissar stepped forward. Benedict drew in a long breath. The barrel of the bolt pistol was cold against his skin. Warmond watched his face almost eagerly.
Do it, Benedict hissed, and quoted an ancient song. Weep for those whose faith is weak. I rejoice, for my faith is bottomless.
He heard the click as the firing pin was brought back. Benedict closed his eyes. There was a long silence. Lord Militant Warmond paused and turned to the savant.
What is General Benedict's old unit?
His savant answered without a moment's pause. Cadian 101st, Tank Regiment.
And where are they serving?
The Gallows Cluster.
Benedict, consider yourself under house arrest. I shall leave you now in the guard of my men. You have 3 hours to apologise to Lord General Reginald.
Or what?
Or you will be sent to the penal colonies, and your name shall be struck off the imperial monuments. Your regiment will be disbanded. Their colours will be consigned to the regimental shrine on Ophelia 4, and the companies will be broken up to fill the ranks of other, more reliable regiments. The name, the proud legacy, the existence of the Cadian 101st shall be no more. The whole regiment shall die with you.
There was a twitch under Benedict's left eye. It pulled once, twice, 3 times. He felt his throat tightening. He felt tears welling up, and by sheer force of will, he drove them back. He dared not blink. He could not show weakness. From somewhere, he felt stillness within him. He closed his eyes and drew in a deep breath.
I will apologise, he said at last, when De Barker does likewise. That'll never happen. Then I'll leave the fate of the 101st in your hands, sir. There is only one way to resolve this honourably. We leave it for the Emperor to decide who is right. Don't think I'm making empty threats, Benedict.
Benedict opened his eyes.
Unfortunately, I don't.
The Lord Militant sighed. He had tried threat and bluster, and neither of them had worked. Now he tried a different tack.
He'll kill you, you know.
That is not certain.
Have you seen him fight?
No, sir.
Well, that's one thing Praetorians are good at, and De Barker is the best duelist on this quadrant.
Benedict nodded. He was strangely calm.
The Emperor will decide.
Benedict stood at the door as the Lord Militant and his staff filed out. Warman's handshake was brief.
You're a stubborn fool, Benedict. It'll be a shame to lose you.
Benedict nodded and said nothing. He did not trust his voice, not to betray him. Warmond gave a curt nod.
Goodbye then, General Benedict. I do not think we shall meet again.
Benedict nodded and shut the door, closed his eyes, and tried to swallow back the grief. But nothing could stem his pain and humiliation. He was Cadian. The Holy Emperor had entrusted his people with a sacred duty to defend the Imperium against the enemies of mankind. To do this, they had been given the best weapons, the best training, forge worlds devoted to furnishing their every need. And they had all failed. Chapter 3. The time and location for the duel were set by their go-betweens. Dawn. Firing range Alpha 2, on the second sub-level of D Quadrant.
It's a quiet spot,
Bendict's adjutant, Mia, said.
On an unused deck of the Imperial Heart, I'm assured no one will disturb you.
When?
Tomorrow morning.
Bendict nodded and took the news with calm detachment. Dueling was officially banned by Administratum Protocol, but it had an archaic status among many martial cultures within the myriad regiments of the Astra Militarum, and there were simple precedents to follow. No armour, no las weapons, no interference from other men, no champions, no psychic tricks. Just a straight duel, blade to blade. It would be left to them. No one would intervene or stop this fight. Just Reginald, Bendict, and their appointed seconds. May the Emperor aid the righteous.
At 0300 hours the next morning, the lights came on in Bendict's chambers. He'd closed his eyes, but sleep had not come. He spent the night thinking back over his life. A child, a cadet, and then the long period of active service, a time he thought of as being both terrible and jubilant. He could hear Mia in the antechamber starting to prepare and pushed himself up. He had not got used to the size of the Ramillies Starfort. It was like being on a planet. Each quadrant had a separate day, so that as one quadrant went to sleep, the next one was waking up. The only sounds were the distant, low hum of the plasma generator, the moan of the superstructure being pulled at by the planet's gravitational field, the echo of other quadrants still at midday, and the resonant clunks of cruisers docking alongside the Ramillies. Bendict was buttoning up his shirt when Mia entered.
I'm sorry to involve you in this.
I'm honoured, Mia said. His involvement in this duel would be a stain on his otherwise untarnished record.
You don't have to come.
I wouldn't be anywhere else, honestly.
Mia stood silently watching as Bendict finished buttoning up his dress jacket of Cadian drab, the embossed brass buttons each individually polished to a parade ground brightness. Bendict laughed bitterly. In a pistol fight, or a match of military acumen, the Praetorian would be a dead man. But the weapons of the duel ring were blades, and Bendict was shorter, smaller, and facing a man whose planet and class meant that duelling was the chief sport. Mia watched his commander closely. He didn't fancy Bendict's chances, and fate being the bitch she was, he knew these would be the last moments he saw his commanding officer alive, so he drank him in, as a man will drink water before going out into the desert. Mia thought back through their days on Cadia, the long sojourn on Observation Post 9983, the time that Creed came to visit them, the wonder of the Salvation Sanctuaries buried under the Cadian landscape, and finally, the long-awaited counterattack, and the dreadful moment when Cadia started to break apart.
My sword, Bendict said, and Mia handed over the sword belt.
Bendict wrapped it around his waist, pulling the buckle tight. His blade was a heavy, chopping broadsword, perfect for cutting through heretic flak armour or helmets, but quite unsuited to delicate duelling. Mia knew how the fight would end. He checked his chronometer. It was nearly 0400, and they still had a long distance between them and the site of the duel.
Are you ready, sir?
Bendict nodded.
Then we'd better go.
The guards outside Bendict's quarters were fellow Cadians. The officer was a thin man with a scarred lip. He stepped in front of Bendict.
May I shake your hand, sir? We all heard what the bastard said.
Afterwards, the officer saluted.
Good luck, sir.
Thank you, Bendict said, and then Mia tugged at his sleeve.
He's here, he said.
Bendict turned. A neutral officer from the Saturnine Dragoons was standing in dress uniform at the end of the corridor,
The man saluted. The lift is waiting, sir.
Benedict shook each of the guards' hands and then followed Mia to the lift. The doors slid into place. Benedict could feel the cool air welling up from below. Then the lift began the long descent. It took them down through deck after deck. From their smell, you could tell what each was used for. The human stink of barrack blocks, the dry, papery scent of administrative silos, the counterseptic of medical wards, the dusty and stale air of uninhabited decks, kitchens, messes, storage chambers, levels that had been put into quarantine in ages past and never unlocked, and finally the physalene stink of the magazines, which were dark, silent, deserted. The temperature rose at first as they approached the plasma reactors, and then dropped as the minutes dragged on and they descended into the bowels of D Quadrant. The hum of the gravitation drives grew louder. At last, the lift slowed, coming to a stop as the floor aligned with its hazard warning stripes. The dragoon had not spoken, but now he took out a piece of parchment and checked the location. "This is it," he said, and unlatched the doors and pushed them open. When they were all outside, he slid the grill door closed again.
"You call the lift with this chain," the dragoon said.
He spoke to Mia, not Benedict.
"It takes some time."
Mia nodded.
"We'll remember that."
The dragoon's cheeks coloured. He looked briefly to Benedict, then nodded.
"This way."
The dragoon turned left and led them through a broad, silent corridor. He kept up a brisk pace, and the two Cadians hurried behind. Lumen strips flickered to life, then extinguished again as they passed by. There were shoulder-height bundles of cabling strung like ship rope along the wall, brass pipes with white labels, wheezing ductworks, and, beneath the floor, the deep hum of local generators. At one point, Mia realised that his hands were sweating. He wiped them on his trousers and tried to concentrate. The grav plates had not been tuned for a long time. In some places, they were running strong, and every step was a strange effort, like wading through water, while by the end of the corridor, they were underperforming, and Mia felt himself float for a moment between each footfall. Going down the steps, Benedict and Mia had to put their hands up to stop their heads from catching on the ceiling. In the darkness, they could feel spaces opening up to either side. Cool breezes came from some, while others blasted hot air at them, tinged with a distinct ozone stink from coolant heat overflow ducts. They passed what smelled like a sewage recycling facility, the greasy smell of gun stores, a doorway with no entry tape crisscrossing the entranceway, the hazard warning stripes still gleaming despite the years of dust. At last, they reached a long, empty, sand-floored firing chamber. Old pressboard targets were stacked against the wall. They were lost in the shadows, but Mia could make out the typical Munitorum issue figures of men and the more common Xenos races, Greenskins, Eldar, Gene Stealers. The galaxy was stocked with terrifying enemies, but humanity's chief danger came not from the hostile universe or from Xenos races, but from within itself. Benedict had spent most of his military life shooting heretics. They came in standard human form. Nothing strange or alien about their shape, usually. It was their minds that were gone. The Saturnine Dragoon paused at a pair of double doors that stood open.
"This is as far as I go."
Mia peered through the doorway.
"So this is it?" "It is, at the far end of this hall. The floor is marked with a skull."
"Cheery," Mia said. The dragoon did not smile. He briefly shook both Cadian's hands, saluted, and turned, his booted feet ringing out on the metal flooring as he made his way back to the inhabited regions. Once he had gone, Mia stepped through the doorway and looked around. The hall was silent, empty, overwhelmingly vast. It made them both feel diminished. There were doors at the far, dimly lit end. They stepped further inside. There was a long, thoughtful pause.
"This is just like Observation Post 9983, Mia said.
Bendix nodded. His memories of that place were of being trapped and impotent. It was not a good omen. It was a short walk until they reached the designated firing range. Like everything on this ship, it was vast in scale and stretched away with low lumens flickering in time with the plasma reactors. No one else was here.
"Are you sure this is it?" Bendix said.
"Yes, sir," Mia said. "Look." Bendix saw a choke saltire underneath the crude image of a skull. He drew in a deep breath. The door was unlocked, the handle clean. He pushed it open. Again, they felt the open space ahead of them. The air was a little warmer, and above the low drone of grav plates, there was the tenor note of the maintenance systems. They walked inside.
"Well, when I was a white shield, I never thought I'd end up like this," Bendix said. "But then I never thought I'd make general either. Thanks to Creed, of course."
Mia looked at him. He was obviously trying to remain cheerful and light, despite the occasion.
"He was a good man." "He was, wasn't he?"
Bendix paused and drew in a long breath.
"Feels odd, talking about him in the past tense."
"Yes," Mia said. He gave a strained smile. "Cadia stands." It was the slogan that Creed had used throughout the 100 days of fighting on Cadia. Once, it had brought hope, but now it seemed almost mocking. Bendix turned away.
"It's ironic when you think about it."
"What?"
"This is exactly what we are deciding here," Bendix said. "Does Cadia still stand, or not?"
Mia caught his gaze. He nodded. There was a long pause. Bendix checked his chronometer.
"Are you sure this is the right place?"
"Sorry, sir, yes. I arranged for us to come down 10 minutes before, Sir Reginald. I thought that you might like to have a look around. I thought you'd like that."
"Good thinking," Bendix said.
Mia was right. It was one of his tics as a commander, to not just rely on reports and other men's opinions, but to get down on the ground, to see and smell and taste the place himself. Bendix turned his back and paced forward, looking about an empty room. The duelling circle had been marked out in chalk halfway up the range. It was 15 paces in diameter, standard form.
"A good killing zone," Bendix said.
The grav plates felt like they were a little off on one side of the duelling circle. Bendix could feel himself being pulled down on that side. He felt out the area. It followed the line of rivets in the metal flooring. He consigned the fact to memory. It might be useful, he thought. You never knew. He puffed out his cheeks. It couldn't be long now. He really ought to start focusing. He was here, he reminded himself, to fight for the honour of every Cadian. They were a rapidly dying breed. Which made his task even more important, because 10, 20, 50 years from now, there might be no Cadians left. No one to show what a fine body of soldiers they had once been. The weight of ages fell on his shoulders. He braced himself for it. If this was his moment to be judged, he would not be found lacking. Suddenly, from the other side of the firing chamber, a door opened, and after a moment's pause, two figures entered. They were no bigger than Bendix's thumb, so distant that the clip-clip of their smart leather boots came a second or so after he saw it.
"They're here," Mia said.
Bendix nodded.
"Yes," he thought, as he took in a long breath. "They were."
Chapter 4. The Praetorians came in their full dress uniform. Spiked topi, red velvet jacket, striped trousers, and pristine white puttees.
Sir Reginald was taller than Bendict remembered, and he took in the long arms, broad shoulders, and smooth, confident gait with a sinking feeling. This was going to end badly, he thought, and felt warmth rising up to his collar. Mia was watching him.
I know what you're thinking, Bendict said.
Mia looked uncomfortable.
You could still apologise.
Bendict took in a deep breath to calm himself.
I think death would be a better epitaph than dishonour.
Mia nodded.
I'll go and greet them.
Sir Reginald II was dressed like his commander. The man had a red lens augmatic monocle, a double-barrelled hotshot las pistol in a worked leather holster, long waxed mustachios, and cheeks so closely shaved the skin was still raw.
Adjutant Mia, Mia said, and put out a hand.
The handshake was brief and perfunctory.
Lieutenant Hezekiah Monstella de Barker, the other man said.
The other man clearly read Mia's expression.
Yes, I am the sister son of Sir Reginald.
Mia nodded. In normal situations, this would have been a conversational opening, but Mia had no interest in prolonging the exchange. They went through the formalities briefly. There was an efficient briskness to their conversation. At last, Lieutenant Hezekiah said,
The appointed time is 5 minutes hence, but as we're all here, shall we start in 3?
The duelists nodded their approval. The adjutants checked the chronometers.
Agreed, Mia said.
The 2 seconds shook hands once more and turned back to their men. Sir Reginald was already warming up. Mia watched him for a moment. He had a fencing rapier with a cup hilt and a long reach. His booted feet moved quickly for such a big man. There was a cruel beauty to the way he covered the ground. The Praetorian looked both lean and clinical. Mia had to drag his gaze away. Bendict looked almost clumsy in comparison as he drew his broadsword, unbuckled his sword belt, and threw it and the sheath away behind him. He rolled his shoulders and made a few quick sweeps of his blade to loosen his wrist. He stepped back and forth, practicing his moves. Mia was too tense to watch. He kept his eyes on his chronometer. With 20 clicks to go, he warned,
Almost time.
Bendict nodded and drew himself up. A few seconds later, the chime rang out. It was a single, high ping. Bendict turned smartly to his second, saluted for the duel to start. As Bendict strode forward towards the chalk circle, Mia whispered to himself, almost as if the words were a prayer,
Cadia stands.
To Bendict, he said,
Kill the bastard.
Chapter 5
Bendict put up a respectable resistance, but as the duel went on, it was clear that the Praetorian was playing with him. Bendict started stiffly, but his breaths grew more and more ragged, his footwork more clumsy. He jumped aside as the Praetorian's blade whistled past where his face had been, but as he fell backwards, the next blow slashed across his left arm. The Cadian let out a snarl of pain and frustration as the razor-sharp blade opened up his dress coat and cut a deep score in his flesh. The next minute was painful to watch. Bendict was bleeding from a dozen wounds. His left arm was cradled, the floor was slick with his blood, and his face was disfigured with pain.
Just kill him and be done, Mia thought.
But the Praetorian was intent on inflicting as much humiliation as possible before the coup de grace. At last, there was a low grunt as the Praetorian's blade sheared through Bendict's wrist. Hand and sword fell with a clatter to the metal floor. Bendict's stump swung pathetically before the Cadian understood that he had lost both hand and weapon. Then the sabre stabbed him in the upper thigh and he fell forward like a penitent on his knees, clutching what was left of his arm, his lifeblood pumping out onto the floor. Mia felt sick.
Just end it, he thought. Benedict clutched the stump as his blood pumped out. The Praetorian stood over him, fresh, untouched, merciless. He lifted his dueling blade and pointed it towards Benedict.
"If you apologize, I will spare you."
Benedict's face was pale. He was going to bleed out. Mia took half a step forward before Benedict answered. He spat at the Praetorian.
"Never!"
The Praetorian sabre flicked casually, cutting a nasty gash across his cheek.
"Beg, Cadian dog!"
Benedict spat the word out, despite the bloody foam that filled his mouth.
"Never!"
Three more blows landed. Benedict cast about and caught his broadsword with his left hand and held it up in a weak defence.
"You are beaten," de Barker announced. "The Holy Emperor has shown my case to be fair and just. The Cadians are disgraced, unworthy. You are a dying breed, and the sooner we are rid of the stench of failure, the better for us all."
Mia made the sign of the Aquila. De Barker prepared to dispatch his crippled enemy with his trademark blow, the stab to the heart. But as the Praetorian stepped forward, Benedict twisted to the side, and with a cry of effort and pain, he threw himself upwards. It was an ugly blow, but it did the job. The point of his blade caught the Praetorian in the gut, and the aristocrat fell backwards, innards slipping out. Benedict pushed himself to his feet. His visage was gore. Blood ran from his mouth and cheek, but he spoke proudly and well as he readied his backhand blow.
"Sir Reginald de Barker, the Holy Emperor has shown my case to be fair and just. You are a dying breed, and the sooner we are rid of the stench of failure, the better for us all."
The broadsword flashed out, and both bodies fell to the ground. Part 2. "My servants, the righteous, shall inherit each earth." Psalm of Guidance. Chapter 1. Minka was as good as dead when they found her in the foothills of Markgraf Hive, arms raised above her head, a warm corpse, waiting to be pulled out from the earth. Each night since then, her dreams have taken her back there, cold and shivering in the Toxpool. Each night, she felt warm hands pulling her free from the embrace of the dirt. And each night, she woke with a start and found herself sitting bolt upright in her cot, eyes wide open, cold sweat running from her armpits, and her heart flapping like a trapped bird in the cage of her ribs. She swung her legs over the bunk and landed softly on the warm metal of the barrack hall flooring. The war for Marquis had been a damned hell, fought in some of the most appalling conditions the Cadians had ever seen. This world was a toxic cesspit, infested with vermin and sump maggots that could take a man's head off with one bite. They had spent weeks underground, being sniped at, ambushed, raided by enemy combat teams, and suffering from lack of sleep or rest. Within days, smart, fit young units had been reduced to starving, filthy, terrified groups of survivors. Now, these survivors called themselves the Hell's Last. However, to the officials of the Munitorum, they were the Cadian 101st. The 1,000 survivors of the once proud 101st now slept on 3-tiered bunks at the stern end of Barrack Hall 9 aboard the Luna-class cruiser Cossack Blade. Acres of empty bunks stretched away along the barrack hall. The unmade beds were testament to the terrible losses their forces had suffered. Minka's fingers traced the ends of each bunk as she made her way through the tightly packed room towards the entrance. Her mouth was dry, her heart was urgent. In that month in the Underhive, Minka had become accustomed to the many types of darkness. She knew its shades and contours, could sense threat long before it struck. She sensed danger now,
as she passed by the cots on her way to the main gates, where a complement of sentries stood at attention in a pool of crackling galvanic light. Now, tonight, the sergeant on duty was Valdez. She knew him by name, but he challenged her as she padded barefoot out of the shadows.
"Who walks tonight?" Valdez demanded.
She was dressed in loose cotton leggings and a camo top.
"Minka Lesk," she said. "Can't sleep?"
"No," Minka said. "I felt something. Something strange." Valdez looked pale. He frowned.
"We re-entered real space half an hour ago."
Minka cocked her head as if listening. The throbbing pulse of warp pressure on the ship had gone, replaced by the low rumble of plasma drives, the creak of structural beams readjusting to gravity, and the low moan of metal as their transport altered course.
"Did we arrive?"
Valdez nodded.
"We're planet-bound as we speak. Portence, capital world of the Gallows Cluster."
"And it's not the front line, is it?"
"I hope not," Valdez said, and laughed briefly. "If it is, then half the sector has fallen since last communications."
He nodded towards a box of parchment that stood by the side of the sentry post. The red wax seals were still warm.
"It's all in there, all the news from the galaxy."
Minka nodded. Through ways that were not clear to her, the planet of Cadia had held the Eye of Terror contained, and its fall had torn a great rift across the Imperium of Man. Those tsunami aftershocks were still rippling through the warp, leaving them blind and deaf whilst in transit, unable to communicate and unable to receive communications. Now, with their return to real space, astropathic links had been re-established, and this was the backlog of Imperial dispatches and orders. Minka said nothing, but the news was like a balm. Perhaps that was it, she thought, and forced a smile. But the truth was, she needed a break. Just enough downtime to get her head straight. A moment to draw breath. A chance to evade the nightmares that haunted her at night. Valdez tossed a file to her. It was a bundle of information posters, still warm from the screen printing rolls. Valdez had slid one of them out from the middle. He held it towards her. The type was smudged. The title of the poster read, "Reinforcements."
"Looks like we're going to make friends."
Minka scanned the notice.
"So we're not being disbanded?"
She tried to take it from him, but Valdez held it back.
"Not yet. They're still working their way down to us."
At the breakfast canteen, there was only the usual, fried slab and reconstituted egg. But there was a buzz in the queue and among the seated soldiers. They'd all noticed that the plasma drives were operational again. They were all looking forward to going planetside.
"Heard the news,"
Trooper Prasan said as Minka queued. Minka was staring off into the distance as Prasan addressed her. He had to repeat himself before she heard him. He was her age, approximately. Had been on Cadia too when the end came. She didn't ask him about it. Didn't want to know.
"We're landing."
"No," he said. "Not that."
"So then, what?"
"We're being brought back to strength."
"Yeah, I heard."
"Know who?"
He didn't wait for her to answer. "Three regiments. The Black Dragons, the Cadian 966th Rifles, and the 2000th Red Skulls." The names meant nothing to her.
"Know anything about them?"
He shook his head.
"Were they... there?"
"Cadia?"
"No, they were on the Eastern Fringe," Prasan said. "There's no record of which war zone the Red Skulls have been involved in. Since their recall, the Black Dragons and the Rifles have been engaged on the northern edge of the Cicatrix Maledictum."
She reached the front of the queue, where strips of lumens kept the food warm.
"Lucky them," she said.
"Not really."
She laughed as she filled her bowl. Yeah, she couldn't think of anything worse than being stuck on a ship for months or years. Prasan followed her as she moved to a table and sat down opposite. They were quiet as they shoveled in their food. After a pause, Prasan spoke.
How are you doing?
Good, she said. You?
Oh, he said. Not bad. I just meant after Marquis, you know.
What?
You know.
Bale sickness?
Oh, that, fine.
She quoted Medic Banting. Nothing a series of injections can't put right. Even in her own ears, she sounded too breezy. He caught the forced jollity in her voice.
Yeah? I hope so.
She looked down and chased the last scraps of egg with a spoon, then shoved them into her mouth and stood, lifting her bowl.
I'd better go. We're disembarking this time tomorrow.
Right, Prasan said, and he half stood. No, don't get up. You eat, I'm fine, honest.
He looked at his slab. It didn't seem so appetising now.
Are you sure?
Of course I'm sure.
He paused.
Well, if you need a hand with anything.
She was defiant as she returned his stare. She had a horrible feeling that he was coming on to her.
Like what?
Oh, he said, I don't know.
Chapter 2. When Minka tried to piece the fragments of memory back together, they were like shards of different pots. They did not fit. From her whole platoon, only she and Grogar had made it out alive through a hell of sump pipes and sewage vats. When the evacuation teams did their final sweep, they had been practically done for, their boots worn through, their insignia almost unreadable. They'd both been shaking so hard they could barely gut a heretic. They'd spent a month in recovery afterwards, pumped full of stims, enduring fevers, lurid dreams and night sweats. Confessor Kerem had come over to them and offered them the Emperor's blessing. Minga had tried to push him off, but she couldn't make herself understood and she was too weak to stop him.
Toxic shock,
Banting, the grey-haired medicae said, sniffing as he flipped through her file and speaking across the bed to his orderly.
Typical for soldiers who have spent too long in the underhive.
Banting flipped through more sheets and turned to go. This was all run-of-the-mill for him.
Nothing a few injections won't cure.
If Minka had been standing, she would have struck the damned fool. But she could barely lift an arm. As they started to walk away, from somewhere she had found the strength to speak. She was a fighter, Throne take them. She was one of hell's last.
10 minutes was too long in that fracking hole,
she'd croaked, and the medigay had looked up and forced a brief smile as he hung her notes back onto the end of her cot.
I'm sure, he said.
The next morning, Minka reported back to the medicae. As she came out, she passed Grogar. She caught his eye and gave a brief nod. She could barely look at him for more than a second, and she guessed the feeling was mutual. Survivor's guilt, or something like that. They'd been through that hell together. She'd die for him, if need be, but until then, she didn't want to see...